You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Man, I feel like it's been a really long time since we've been in here together, Kevin.
It feels rusty at times.
Yeah.
It does. We missed Thanksgiving week, which was good. Sorry for all of you that didn't get to listen, but how was your Thanksgiving? I don't think I asked you that.
It was a little lackluster this year.
Not enough stuffing?
Well, like normally Katie's family gets together and we do this huge, way over the top.
Oh, okay.
Way too much food. And
Yeah.
We just sit on the couch and like can't breathe afterwards.
Meat sweats all day long.
Tryptophan overdose.
Yeah.
But her brother moved to Tennessee.
Okay.
Her sister moved to Colorado, and that critical mass that draws like all the external family isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
So it was just...
It's so funny.
Our family and Katie's parents.
Yeah. I've grown up in very small families. So, like, my dad's an only child. I only knew two of my grandparents, and they both passed when I was really young. And so we just have like this, and my mom's family is kind of dispersed. So we just have this like really small family. And so like big family gatherings are always such like a mystery to me.
Really?
So we're just not used to those. Yeah. So we had a small one, but it was like average for us. It was like, we went to my in-laws.
I want you to come to a passion family gathering.
I don't think I have the vocal chops for that, man. I don't think I could, you'd let me in.
Oh,
how musically talented your crew is.
You got some skills. I've heard you. You could play guitar.
I can play guitar. I'm laughing because you know I hate that you just shared that, because I don't tell that to anyone. Because I play youth pastor guitar, as I affectionately call it, which means I'm pretty good with a capo.
You can play caged.
Caged.
C-A-G-E-D.
Yeah. Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all you need, man.
That's all you need. Speaking of performers.
We should switch spots on a Sunday. That'd be really fun.
People wouldn't notice because we look so much alike. They would notice when I started singing. But speaking of performing, somebody had a show this weekend.
That's right.
Man, how...
Right in North Carolina, Michael W. Smith was performing with Amy Grant.
Just have a constant Michael W. Smith radar?
I do. I see every single one of his posts every single day. I really do.
That's awesome. But bro, you had your Christmas show.
I did. And you went.
I know I went. It was
so good. For a while
there,
I didn't think you were going
to
go.
Yeah. It was mainly because I was just too lazy to buy a ticket. But I did. I got around to buying a ticket. But
do you think people are flabbergasted that I didn't comp you a ticket?
You offered, to your credit.
Okay.
You did offer. I said I'll support you by paying that ticket. But after seeing a darn near sold out show, I wish I would have asked for the comp ticket. You didn't need the help, man. You sold it out. No, it was so good. I don't know how to, I imagine you're, this is a little later in the week than we normally record, but I know we didn't record on Monday because I'm sure you were just zonked, but
it was.
It was so good, man. It was so good. I know, and there's a ton of CPCers there that got to be
there.
And a ton of others, too.
It was a really good show, and I mentioned for the first time in front of, you know, I do shows and stuff, but this is the, Katie brought it up. She said, when you called yourself a pastor...
Yeah.
At a, you know, what she calls a Brandon Passion show. Very different from worship. And I've kept those two separate for years.
Yeah.
And in this season, God is integrating the two.
Yeah.
Which is really, so really good. Cool. And so, yeah, I called myself a pastor in front of a room of like 800 people.
Yeah. It was so good, man. No, it's fun to watch. Like I was driving home and Lindsay was out of town. So I was flying solo. But I was just driving home thinking it's so fun to watch. Like, the enormous amount of work I'm sure it took to put into that, but just seeing you in your element, like doing your thing, and kind of it was a cool night. So
thanks,
proud of you, man. You crushed it.
It was
bring
really,
it into
really
Christmas season.
All right, I have a deep one for you to start off.
Hit
with.
Me with it,
because I thought your sermon was really, really thought provoking on Sunday. So calling this podcast Trust Issues. That's what we're going to name it. I don't know if Sandy will name it that or not, but
yeah,
I want to start off with, if you could recall a time, and I'm glad to start if you can't think of one, but
yeah,
where you have had a massive trust breach, not you creating the trust breach, but someone else like way letting you down.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it could be from any time in your life.
Okay. The first one I thought of goes back to, this is going to be, man, sixth or might have been sixth grade, Kevin. It might have been seventh grade. Anyway, early middle school, late elementary school.
Had you hit your growth spurt yet? Were you as tall as you are now?
No, I hit that. No, I was I was wider than I was taller, I think, at that point. So I hadn't stretched out yet.
Oh, okay.
Hit, that was probably eighth grade.
You were in the awkward, like, junior high chubby phase.
Oh, man. Middle school is so awkward. I was definitely in that awkward phase. But I was invited to my first boy-girl party. So this was, like, a big deal by Kristen Colwell. Who's not listening to this, I'm sure. So that would be so random. But she invited me over for her birthday party. And so it was like a big deal. Like, this is the first one. I'm like just all sorts of nervous. And she told me, you know, I forget how many friends were there. There's probably like 8 friends there, 10 friends or something. And she told me for her birthday that she was throwing a Barbie themed party. And I was like, we're in seventh grade. This doesn't make sense. I don't understand. But she like sold me on it. And so I went all in. So like I went down to the store and like I got her like this Barbie as a gift. And I'm like, this doesn't feel right. But I didn't want to show up without a gift and be like super awkward. So I show up at the party. And not only am I the only one to bring a gift, like no one else brought a gift. The one that she opened in front of everyone is this like Barbie. And it was like they all just were just mocking me relentlessly.
Oh,
so little sixth grade Kevin was just torn apart.
Why would she do this just to mess with you?
I think it was just to mess with me. Cause all sorts of self-doubt and therapy sessions.
You know what I was thinking? Like if you, like when you write your book and you become a famous author.
Yeah. There's a big market out there for niche theology books around the smells of theology.
But I feel like, isn't it weird to think, like, there are people, like, you know, that are famous to the level that if they say a name like that, like, there's a good chance
that, yeah, that's
that
weird.
They'll be listening.
That they will have. Like, if Taylor Swift mentions a childhood friend
it's
or writes an album
everywhere.
About it, it's everywhere. They're not avoiding that.
Oh, that would be horrible.
That sounds like I would not want to know a famous person.
Right.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. It's, or at least do something bad to a famous person.
Yeah. What's your trust story? What's your trust? Failure.
David Herbelsheimer.
That is Herbelsheimer?
Yeah.
That I think I said this earlier to you because you told me this name. That is the perfect childhood friend name. David Herbelsheimer. It's perfect.
I don't want you hanging out with David Herbelsheimer anymore. Yeah, I was, as I've said before, sixth grade was a tumultuous time for
it's the worst, man.
For me. But it was my brand of hard was because we were homeschooled in fourth and fifth grade. And so when we reintegrated back into sixth grade, not only were we coming back into public school and like shocked by how far kids had advanced. Like, I saw someone like kissing someone in the hallway.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was some eighth graders that kissed in the hallway. And I was traumatized. I couldn't believe it. It's like, I've only seen this in the movies. My mom and dad don't kiss like that. But anyway.
Is this in Iowa? Are you in Iowa?
Yeah, in Iowa. So that's the other thing that makes it
David Herbelsheimer worse. Sounds like an Iowan name too. That's good.
But when you go to a school for the first time in Iowa, these kids have grown up together.
Yeah. You know, everyone, small town living.
They don't leave. Like like it's not like a transient area. They're there for generations. Yeah. And so everybody knows the Herbelsheimers and you know, this guy, these people from California that say soda instead of pop, you really stick out. And so I was trying so hard not to stick out, but I joined the band and David Herbelsheimer was a drummer and he had these sticks. They were like, I still remember them exactly. They were like hot pink drumsticks on like the first half of the stick. And then the bottom had like a spray painted grip on it.
Oh yeah.
And they were like, so, you know, I was
just dreamy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was a drummer too. And so that was my first instrument. And he,
that's awesome.
Yeah. And so he convinced me that I should buy these sticks. And like they're, I was like, those are so cool, hot pink and, you know, like 90s all the way. And he's like, yeah, I mean, you could buy them from me if you want. They're pretty cool. And I was like, well, how much would they be? He goes, well, they're really expensive. You know, I'll cut you a deal. And I think he was going to sell them to me for like $20.
Yeah.
And at that season in our lives, $20 was a big ask.
Yeah.
You know, I think like I went home and offered to mow like a lawn and they paid me like $2.
Yeah.
Like, so I begged my parents, they had no money. And so I just worked and worked and worked and tried to like, you know, come up with $20.
Yeah,
and I finally did. And I bought the drumsticks off, and he was just like, he sold like features that don't exist on drumsticks. You know, he was like, yeah, when you hit these, they, if you hit them just the right way, they light up. You can never see it, but you know.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Yeah.
And I finally.
What were those shoes? The LA Gears. They're Gears of drumsticks.
I loved that. I loved LA Gear. And they came up with the Reebok pump, lookalikes.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because no, my parents wouldn't buy me the Reebok pumps because they were like $120. But the LA Gear had them.
LA Gear pumps. That's awesome.
To make your shoes tighter. Anyway, this is going on way too long. But essentially, I went to we were at some music store or something, and I saw the sticks, and they were like $5.
And that's after you'd paid him 20.
After I'd paid him $20, you know, I was playing mom and
Herbalsheimer strikes again.
And I didn't. I was so innocent. I didn't even. Think that I thought maybe it was just a mistake and that he was mistaken.
They were like mislabeled, like you went to the store owner, like, yeah, you have the wrong price,
or
on
that
these.
That David misremembered, or that he got the wrong sticks or something, or he got ripped off, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just, there's no
defending him.
I didn't have categories that he would have just lied to me.
Yeah.
Just same way with the birthday party.
Yeah.
With
you. Yeah.
Like, you didn't, when we're back
was,
there,
it was
we
totally
trust.
Like, yeah. It seems weird, but I would assume you're telling the truth. Why would you want to hurt me?
Yeah.
You know, why would, like, you make that kind of decision?
It's the saddest thing.
Yeah.
When you look at junior hires, realizing how harsh the world is. That's what makes junior high so hard.
That's a good point.
And I feel like that's getting younger and younger, too. Like,
yeah.
There are elements of that Charlie, my 8-year-old, is experiencing now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which like churns, you know, that's why I think often you come out of middle school with this sort of like cynicism towards the world, right? Because it all of a sudden looks a little bit bleaker than it did going in. That like mystique of it as a kid, that's like just everything churning up roses, you know, for most people. Obviously, this is speaking in generalities of people's, you know, experiences as a child, but in a normal setting, yeah, that kind of wears off in middle school. It's tough.
But I think, you know, because of that and probably a lot of other reasons that require extensive counseling, we have trust issues. That's kind of what I was pulling from this, because you talk about this Advent season and the struggle between the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, between these two trees. Between the tree of life and then between
the tree of life again reemerges
the tree of
in
life
Revelation 21.
We struggle.
Life is hard. Yeah. Between those. Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of that is this struggle of trust.
Yeah. Yeah. And we come, and that's where I think there's this, you know, this is why I love the Advent season, is because we rush into Christmas so much. And that story I told of Madison, my middle schooler, speaking of sixth graders, kind of coming to grips with the reality of the world. Like, how can we celebrate when there's like war and brokenness and racism and hunger and like all these different things? And I think it's because we tend to run straight to Christmas and like the joyful season. But again, the teaching of the church calendar would be that we celebrate Advent before. And that's that way of just remembering that the story in which the incarnation takes place, when Jesus is born and comes into the world, is it's not in the midst of like just life as normal. Like it's into a very dark night that Jesus comes. Like it's the people of God being crushed by the Romans, more or less in like utter obscurity, thinking there's no way we could conquer this massive empire. Like all hope is lost. And yet they had this story, this long story they had told generation after generation about God's promise of the Messiah coming. And it's into that story that joy comes. So when you get this like joy to the world, the Lord has come, like we sing that flippantly, like, oh, it's post Thanksgiving. We just start singing that. But there's no context for like the darkness of something like Advent, where it's like we recognize the brokenness of the world. And I just think it's one of the beautiful things the church has to offer the world is a coherent story of brokenness, because the world doesn't have categories, kind of like how you didn't have categories for Herbalsheimer or whatever his name was to like think of that brokenness. Like in some ways, Advent gives us that language and that story to say the world is broken. But that's not the end of the story.
Yeah.
Which is the importance of I think, experiencing that. It's the same thing with Lent, right? Lent looks square at death and says, "From dust you came, to dust you shall return." And so it doesn't skirt the harsh realities of the world. It looks them in the eye and then provides the hope, right, of Jesus coming, of God becoming flesh into that brokenness. And so it doesn't cause us to look past those things, but it contextualizes something like joy and happiness. It removes it from circumstances because then it's something deeper and it can then absorb kind of the brokenness of those particular circumstances. Mm. So it steps into that kind of like those trust issues, like, which is really that life between the two trees is us wrestling with do we trust in the brokenness that God is still moving and working, or do we seize control and say, nah, the only one I can trust is myself. And so then I have to go and make those particular choices or whatnot.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking when you were saying that Advent is something that we can actually offer the world, and there's a lament in the midst of that, right?
Yeah.
And also with Lent. I had a worship leader tell me, a colleague, I wouldn't necessarily say he was a friend, but a worship leader colleague tell me a couple of years ago, there's no place for lament in a church service.
Ugh.
We always need to keep it joyful and positive.
Yeah. I think that's so damaging.
I know. Where does that come from? Why? We don't want people to feel sad? Like,
I think that is. I think it's an addiction to our emotions. And again, like as we look at kind of the modern world, and even like I think in particularly our context in America, and even more so maybe even in the Bay Area, is that the majority of people have the means to numb most of their deeper pain. Mm. And so then why would we expose that when we can just cover it up and rush past it or buy the next thing or take the next trip? And in some ways it does make you feel good. Like even putting it into the story in Genesis 1 or 2 and 3, Eve looked at the fruit and it did look good. It was good. And it was good for wisdom. But again, it gets back to the trust thing. Like, and I don't think that's flippantly saying like it looked good, but really it's poisonous. It looks like, I think it's a genuine, it looks enticing. And I think at times the church can lean into that joy because we do have the most hopeful story in the world that is coherent.
Yeah.
But it has to still make sense of the fact that like on the way to that hope, Jesus died. Like we can't, like that's the pinnacle.
Yeah.
We can't overlook that. And I think he could have saved the world in any way he wanted. But what he's doing in there is I think that it's Jesus, it's God entering into the very human condition. And there's a sort of empathy that is fostered there. And so it then removes that sort of need for circumstantial happiness or joy and says, no, we can carry all of that baggage that's just inherent to being human. And then we can actually deal with it. Because if we just sit in joy, we suppress it. We don't ever actually deal with the underlying issues there, which when we get to like Revelation, then when we see that tree pop up again, it's creation remade, brand new from the inside out, like all of creation, not just our own souls, but the very material world remade void of brokenness. Then we can sit in joy. But right now there's very real like rot, if you will, that we have to stare at. And lament, I think, is actually like, man, I think it's one of the greatest gifts. Because the world can't lament. They don't have a coherent story to really lament. But the church does.
If you have, I mean, if you think about it, if you have no hope to point to, then running from lament is your only option.
Yeah.
Let me try to stave it off as long as I can. Let me try to outspend it. Let me try to outlove it. Let me try to, you know, out-travel it, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and you see this frantic, like, let me just put as much as I can between me and what's really awful about this world. And you're seeing massive rises of depression and suicides. And
this is where even like the act of confession is such a gift, because confession offers you the opportunity to deal with the brokenness, where if we run from confessing our sins, whether it's to others or, you know, to God or to, you know, whatever it is, like, and obviously the practice of confession has been distorted over the years too. Of course, there's always that side of it. But confession is a way of saying, I recognize brokenness. I recognize my own ability to contribute to brokenness. And so I'm going to confess that. And then it actually is the beginning place of healing.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that beginning place, you can't ever heal. And so to outspend, out, you know, travel, out experience our own pain and brokenness never actually brings healing. Like, you have to look.
And there's always a moment where it catches you.
Yeah. And then it blows up far more, you know, and even if it doesn't ever catch up to you, because I think there is a sense where you know, it probably will, but you could suppress it enough, spend enough if you're in the right kind of, you know, economic class. But there's that deep ache that's always there. It's always, I mean, that's,
well, I'll tell you, you know, something that Tony and I talked about with the show, and Tony, for those of you that don't know, is he plays keyboard every week.
The maestro.
But he also created like 12 original string arrangements for that show, which
it's incredible.
If I wish I could describe to you what kind of work.
I can't even imagine.
On so many levels, how much work that is for him. But, you know, we were talking and we put together this whole show, and we've been working on it since, you know, July.
Yeah.
And so you basically have half a year of not thinking about it, and then you go to work again on it. And we were just talking about how when it was over, you know, so the whole thing, you know, for 3 hours, you work for 6 months for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And then, like, I packed up my stuff, you know, most people, like, leave really soon. So it's me and, like, you know, four other people at the theater at, like, 12:30, you know, getting things done.
Yeah.
And I was describing him my drive home. And, you know, we had gotten in and out as a team, you know, it was like five of us. And then I drove home with my in and out, and Tony said he got a sandwich at Safeway.
Yeah.
And he went home and sat down with his sandwich all by himself. And we just described sort of the moment that we both experienced after it, and how fast those things,
how fleeting it is.
Fleeting it is, and how the things that we, like, if we want to take that show, like, if that show is, if the point of it is to make us feel valued and worthwhile.
Yeah.
Which is what we do, right? Yeah. With all these other things that we mentioned.
Yeah.
If that's the point of the show, it works for about 3 hours.
Yeah.
And then it's the hardest fall in the world.
Yeah,
And then you start having to lean on other stuff. Like, let's hear what people thought of the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or, you know, what did you think? And so, you know, that stuff never really goes away, but thank God, you know, I've done the work with him, where that isn't the driving force behind what I do.
It's the trapping of Christmas, right? Like, and I love Christmas time. Like, the Friday after Thanksgiving, I'm all in. Like, I'm lights and the tree and Dean Martin and Bing Crosby and, like, bring it on. Like, I love it. But there is that moment when you pack up all the decorations, put them back in your garage, and you realize it didn't fully satisfy if it's only about that. But if it's about, again, God's movement in the world and that ultimate hope that we have to restore our own, like, longings and wants, like, that's to come, and that will in fact come. And so that has, like, this deeper healing effect if we can push beyond, right, the tinsel and the lights. And that's all fun to do. Like, I'm not even one that's down on that, but they point to a greater reality.
You said something that I thought that spurred on another question I think is really important. You said that Jesus could have chosen to save the world in any way he wanted.
And yeah.
Do you think that, do you ever wonder, like, why Jesus didn't come as a super baby?
my head went to, like, 1,000 different places on what a super baby is. Like, did your kids ever watch the show Boss Baby?
Yeah.
Oh, that's where my mind went. It's like CEO Jesus just strutting around in a suit and tie. Super baby.
I tried really hard to set that up so seriously.
You did. I was ready for a deep
with my most sincere voice. talked about work. I thought it was really interesting that you know, work actually before the fall was like a good thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And but the way that you, the context that you put that in is that God actually gave us some of his authority. Like, when you see him setting up that garden and, you know, naming the animals and all that kind of stuff, like, he gave us authority to co-rule with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole problem is what we did with that authority, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, that, I forget what verse it is in there, but it says that he placed Adam in the garden to work it and take care of it. And those two verbs become really important because they're the, they're getting the meaning to what the human is doing. Like, in some ways it's getting at that question of, like, was God just bored? And so he created a world. Like, No, that's not why God created the world. Like he wanted to enlist us in co-ruling over creation. And so when it says that we were made in God's image, that moment is so deeply profound because it gives independent dignity to each individual life. Like that's a huge piece of it. But one of the things we often overlook is that idea of imaging is the idea of ruling. That's royal language. In the same way that you would have a particular ruler, like let's say it's a mayor, is supposed to rule on behalf of the larger governing body. Like it's to image that rulership in a particular area. And so when God says you're created in the image of God, the idea is when he places us to work it and take care of it, is he's saying, go now and rule over creation as if in the same way that I would rule.
Wow.
And so that's the task of the human, which is why work is around pre-fall, pre-sin, is it's a good thing. Like, and I think we feel this, I think particularly in our area, very driven area, where we have this innate desire to build and to create and to bring beauty out of chaos. Like, that's what it means to be human. And what you see at the example of the two trees, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, is in our authority. God has given us that choice, that free will, to then act and image either God or ourself into the world. Is what you see in that moment is the human wrestling with the decision, will I then rule in the man? Will I image God? Will I rule in the way as if God were me? Or will I rule in the way that I desire and bring about my good ends?
Yeah.
And in some ways, to co-create the world with God, to be a co-ruler with God, necessitates that we have the freedom to then choose and to give us that opportunity to have free will and to be able to decide and to create and do all of that. Like it's by its nature that's necessary, which is profoundly beautiful.
Yeah.
Because that makes God vulnerable to us doing exactly what we did.
Right. And about how inefficient, how inefficient a way that is for God to, the way we look at it, I feel like we just get this wrong all the time. Like he involves us in a way that makes it arguably much messier and harder.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like you gave me, tell the analogy that
The example I think of, so like, our Sabbath practice, we used to do donuts. But our family has shifted now. It's been a big shift in the Snead house. We make waffles every Saturday morning now. And one of the things, I could make Bisquick waffles in about 4 minutes, I'm pretty sure, and it'd be pretty darn clean. Like it's not going to get a big mess.
Yeah.
But the beauty in it, right, is that Adley, every single Saturday, my little six-year-old's like, Dad, I want to make the waffles with you, right? Which immediately, if it wasn't Sabbath, I'd probably be like, no, I got to get to work or whatever. Like, I don't want you to help me. But
this
because it's
cause
Sabbath,
much more pain,
is I usually say yes to that. And so what that usually entails is, right, she pulls up a chair next to the counter. She's like, I want to pour this and I want to stir this. And it is like a freaking bomb went off in our kitchen where there's just Bisquick everywhere, right? There's eggshells in the waffles, like the whole bit. And so I know it's inefficient. I know it's not nearly as
in the waffles. Do waffles have eggs?
Yeah. You gotta put one egg in there. It helps congeal everything.
I didn't know that.
If you
pancakes don't though, right?
No, pancakes have two eggs, I believe. At least according to Bisquick. Oh. Crusties. Do you use Crusties? That's like just add water.
I don't even know what I use. Clearly it's been a long time
since you've made a waffle. But that's the idea, right? Is me and my authority over the waffle situation on Saturdays, give Adley some authority and say, hey, I want to co-create with you. Mm. And that inherently opens it up to being more vulnerable. And that's what we see God doing. And so when he gives that choice, the humans, again, I mean, the two trees, the choice between the two trees plays out in every single day of our life, every single day, every biblical character, every one of us are faced with that choice. Will I rule in the manner of God or will I seize autonomy and seize my own power and then see what happens?
This is the struggle of humanity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you even mentioned it, what's the very next story after the garden?
Yeah.
It's Cain and Abel.
It's Cain and Abel. It's murder right there introduced, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why I think, when God poses that question, which is really the first command I love, the first command that God gives in all of the scriptures is eat, eat. We talked about it. He says, the very first thing he says is enjoy my creation. go out, eat of anything here. I've made this. I want you to enjoy it. Eat of the tree of life. It's there. If you partake in it, it's available. He says, but don't eat from that tree, which is, again, representative of seizing control, seizing authority, living under your own wisdom. And then again, the phrase there is, you'll die. You know, he's saying you'll surely live and enjoy life, or you'll surely die.
And we've applied something to this scripture, or maybe a lot of us have been taught something in this scripture as we've grown up, as God saying, you know, I'm going to kill you
and I'll kill you. Yeah.
If you eat this, I will kill you, which you're kind of saying we need to look
at it. It's nowhere in the text. Yeah. It's nowhere there. It isn't. It's a punishment insofar as because God has our best interest in mind, when we disobey, it leads to less than life. So like, it's a punishment in that sense, but it's not the heavy handed, I'm inflicting death on you. It's death is the result of not living into the way of Jesus, into the way of God.
It's almost like a warning of what could happen.
Yeah.
You'd mentioned, like, if you know, you don't want your kid to go out and play in the street.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like because I'm gonna kill them if they do, but because cars drive there and that could very well swell up in that. And so we project this image kind of onto God of this angry. And again, there are times, no doubt, throughout the scriptures where God does in fact punish directly and to help correct a child. It's the same thing of when I ground Adley for playing in the street. I do inflict a kind of punishment on her, but it's for her benefit. But in this instance, it's not disobey and die. It's, I want you to enjoy all of this, but just know that if you seize control, this will lead down a path you don't want to go. It'll lead to death. And so there's kind of this big kind of, again, I think a projection onto God, which I think really frames how we understand God. Because if that is that God, that angry God that's waiting to punish and kill us, then of course we have trust issues. That makes it makes a ton of sense that I wouldn't trust that God. But if the story, as it's written in Genesis 1 and 2, is, I've created this for you. You have full access to the gift of eternal life right here. It's available. Partake in this. Then that's a God you can trust.
Yeah.
It's built on that good news, not necessarily the beginning. The story begins in Genesis 1, not Genesis 3. And often we speak of God as if it begins with sin, but it begins with good creation.
But this idea that God, you know, in so many ways in the Advent season and Christmas story, you know, makes himself vulnerable.
Yeah.
This idea that, you know, in order for us to be free to love him, to freely choose to love him, we also have to be free to reject him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And he knew that in many ways he would be rejected by us.
Yeah. 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 There is that, like, that paradox, if you will, right? Of love can never be coerced. Or else it becomes less than that. You know what I mean? Which is the beauty of, like, when we think of God as this triune three-in-one being, which all, with all of this kind of mutual self-giving love to one to the other, like, the essence of that is pure selflessness built into the very essence of kind of like the being of God. He's saying that's how love works, is this constant flow of, like, laying your life down for the other kind of thing. And the only way to do that is if you, again, as you said so well, like, you have the choice to not. It's the only way that you can lay your life down for the other. And so God just embodies that. Mm. You know, you see that so clearly here.
There are definitely times when I want to force my daughter Olivia to love me.
It'd be easier if you could, right?
Yeah. The other night she gave me a hug, and it was the happiest. I told Katie, I was like, I'm going to ask Livy for a hug. What do you think my chances are of actually getting a hug? And she's like, 1 in 1,000,000. And she gave me a hug. It was the happiest moment of my life.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
But if I could put a chip in her brain to give me hugs, it wouldn't mean anything.
Exactly.
You know?
It would,
the Neuralink.
It would be void, yeah.
The Neuralink? That's what...
I know what Elon's working on. It's like, terrifying.
So I want you to... This is really fascinating. And I don't know if this is a... If this is a sidetrack, but this idea that of death as a mercy, can you unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah, so you see that, like, once the human chooses to rebel, right, to seize authority on their own, to image themselves, not image God, into the world, the spiral effect, as we mentioned, is Cain and Abel that results in like this guy Lamech who's cheering over the murder of like 7 times 7. I forget the way he words it. So that then swells up into the Tower of Babel, which is this sort of systemic injustice, the systemic sin, where it's integrated now even beyond the individual human, but into the culture. Like there's all
saying,
this.
We want to be God.
Yeah, exactly. We want to be God. We want to see. We know what's best. And so you see this just spiral effect of sin.
I'm glad we got over that complex of wanting to be.
Yeah, we never struggle with any of that anymore.
Yeah.
Never. But it's so then right after kind of they seize that autonomy and they rebel, God exiles them from the garden because it says explicitly in there, if they were to, in this state of brokenness, to partake in the tree of life, they would live forever in that broken state. And so when God exiles them, we see that as, again, this kind of, we tend to read into it as a heavy-handed punishment. But think about what could have been if you're bent towards evil and then there's never an end to that. You never die.
Oh, man.
I mean, that's a sort of, again, a sort of hell that we can't even comprehend.
Yeah.
And so the exiling from the garden is this deep mercy of God, because then whatever evil is perpetuated by any individual human, it's limited by the essence of its life. Like at some point that person will
die.
There
will be an end to the evil from a particular person.
Exactly. From a particular person. Obviously it spirals out into systemic and all that. And that's all coming to an end as well. But there's a limiting effect to that, that it can't just time over time, continue to grow and perpetuate. Wow. It can be passed on. But when he exiles them, it's this deep act of mercy that's saying, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to fix this deeply human problem. But it's going to take time, if you will. And we have to then expel you. We have to keep you from living forever. And so death becomes this deeply like merciful act, because death is not the final step.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without the resurrection, it would have been this very dark moment. But because resurrection and new creation is coming, death is actually an act of mercy for the state of broken humans. You know, I don't mean that flippantly. If you know, part of that brokenness is innocent people die all the time and people are taken too quick, of course. But when we just look at kind of the average case, like death is a mercy because God's recreating the world and he's making it new, and then he will one day in the resurrection of all things invite us back into that to where we can then see a garden restored.
Yeah.
And renewed and actually made into a city, something even more than the garden, where we live forever into that.
You kind of boiled a lot of this down into maybe one question, and that is, do you trust God knows or God has what's best for you?
Yeah.
And I guess maybe one question I'll ask you in response to that question is, do you think that we always know what's best for us?
Do we think we always know? Oh, I would say easily.
No, do you think we always know?
If we trust God or not?
No, do we always know what's best for us?
Oh, no. That's super easy. That's why I was like, are you sure you're asking that? Like, oh my gosh, I don't think we always know. I think, and it happens, I think, in two different layers, right? Like the first layer is at a functional, how I actually live, whether or not it aligns with what I would verbally say, I believe. Like, and those are always, you know, not always, but they...
Aspirational versus, yeah.
Yeah, versus, yeah, exactly. Those are always often out of step. Like, part of being a mature, integrated person is bringing those more and more into alignment.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're always out of step. And so there's always that functional, like, you know, that kitschy example I used forever ago, right, is like, I know salad and chicken is what I should eat every single night. Like, just, you know, grilled chicken breast, but man, do I love Greek food, what I had last night. Like, I love a good, like, you know, taco or something. And so it's like that same sort of thing. Those are out of step. Our thinking and our loves are different. But then the other place it takes is I think we do get into those positions where even in our idealized state, like where we want to say we know what's best, we still give in and fail to that. Like that's, is it Titus, right? It says, the one who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins.
Yeah.
Like that's, like, of course that's in us, where I know.
And that's called rebellion.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah, an outright kind
that's
of.
That's where you say, look, I know, you know, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And we've all kind of been at that place at
and
some
what,
point.
What's hard often with that, or maybe what's so unrelenting on that, is often in those moments when we know we shouldn't do it, those aren't necessarily always like the big things. Like sometimes they are. But often it plays out in more culturally accepted sense.
Yeah.
Where it's like, just take a few more extra drinks. Just sleep with that person. Just cut corners on your taxes. Just do this to get the raise. Like, and those in those kind of culturally acceptable sins are where I think we see the devastation fall, and where I think a lot of this trust is tested more, because it feels more benign. It's, again, it's Eve looking at the fruit. It looks kind of good, and it probably will advance me in my career. Like, sometimes the lie they tell actually comes true, in the sense of it does get you what you think it would get you, but it might not be what's for your ultimate best and what God is trying to grow in us.
You know, what's funny is even thinking about this with Adam and Eve, something kind of a principle that I've learned over my years of rebellion is, if you want, you can always find someone to join you in your rebellion.
Yeah.
You know, you can find someone that will help you justify what you're doing. It almost seems like, in a way, Adam was that person for Eve.
Yeah. I it's funny, I would have flipped it the other way. Because you see Adam kind of in the back, just hanging out.
Yeah.
And I think of it more a little bit like, I want to do what she does, but I'm going to let her get in trouble. You know what I mean? Like, it's that, like, I'll let her do it, you know? And I think it is. I think there's that sense. And think, again, of how we're created, getting back to even that idea of God as Trinity, God as community. So we are social beings. And so there is a social dynamic to it that it constantly is pulling towards, because that's who we are. And in that brokenness, of course, that expands into that space. Where you're like, I could find someone else to do this with. And then it you justify it in your head. Everyone was doing it. You know, it's the classic, like, go back to middle school peer pressure conversation you have, right? Like, we become like who we hang out with more often than not. And it doesn't mean we seclude ourselves, but it means like
David Herbolsheimer.
Like David Herbolsheimer, man. Like, I bet you were slinging those, like, peddling drum sticks. 25. 25 bucks, you know, you flipped them.
Got to make it back, man. Yeah.
So, but I think this question of trust, you know, I think is so, and we're going to look at that a bit this week when we look at Psalm 1 as our text. So we look at that tree. Siri, my Apple Watch couldn't find trust. That's what she just blurted out.
Even Siri has a hard time.
Has trust issues. But we'll look at this again. The tree planted by the streams of water is, again, this choice of trust of, like, it really gets down to this, again, this idea of allegiance. Like, where is your allegiance? Is it foremost with God, or is it foremost with yourself? And that'll cause a lot of problems if it isn't with God.
So I think there are probably people, chances are there are probably people that listened on Sunday, or maybe even hearing this now, that could be in kind of an active rebellion. Like, they're living in something, or they're a part of something or whatever, and they're saying, you know what? It looks good. It feels good. I know it's not right. I know it's not good for me, but I'm just doing it anyway. But I think there are also probably people that are maybe not looking close enough, and they're assuming that that the path they're on, they know it's the best, or they think it's what's best for them, but God might actually have something different.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone like that?
Yeah, I think I'd probably take the posture that I see so often with God and Jesus, you see it all over, of like, there's two paths to life. The narrow path that leads to life and the wide one that leads to destruction. And he's not, again, this like hammer smacking you into that space. He's just saying, here's your choice, and take it for where you want. And so I think with that person, I would just challenge them to think, like, is that what you most deeply want? Like, do you really desire that? And how has that played out in your life? And it may not even have been a train wreck, but just launch that out over the next 30 years. You know, like, I think of that, the passage that keeps coming to mind is when Jesus, that passage on prayer where he says, don't go into the street corners and pray for all to see. He says, because if you want them all to see, you'll get that reward.
Yeah.
Like, you'll get that. And if that's what you want, you'll get it. But kind of like what you said, that as you're driving out of the In-N-Out, you know, drive through that night after your show, it was like, huh, if I really wanted the praise and glory of people, I got it. For 3 hours, I got it. And now it's done. And now what? You know, and if you didn't have a deeper kind of source of meaning and identity,
yeah,
that would be a very kind of nihilistic, broken moment where you're like, that's it. But Jesus says instead, you know, he says, don't pray on the corners, but go into your closet.
Yeah.
Pray in silence where your Father hears you. He says, if that's what you want, if you want the eye and the affection of God, it's there for you. It's just going to be done in a different way. And so I think that's where all these decisions play out. What is your deepest desire? And I would just suggest, I know we're created for eternity. It's been yeah. placed in the heart of man. And that longing that you may have, you can chase it, but I just wonder if it's going to leave you high and dry at the end of it, because there's something more that you're created for and that you long for.
I'm wondering if you can read to close this. What came to my mind is Jesus, and maybe you can do it from memory. Are you tired? You know, are you heavy laden?
Yeah, yeah. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest.
We feel that ache
yeah.
in our souls. Even if things aren't exploding or imploding yeah. in our lives, most of us feel the ache that maybe the alignment isn't there, that maybe what we're chasing is not bringing us what we always hoped it would.
Yeah.
That maybe the thing that we're living for isn't the thing that we really want to live for.
Yeah.
And I think about those words, and I think about Jesus promising us rest.
Hmm.
And that's, I mean, the rest of a fulfilled relationship with the creator of the universe. I mean, that's what we're looking for.